We're talking about our nation's debt burden on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, she testified before the House Appropriations Committee Thursday, saying it's critically important to have a responsible fiscal policy and not burden future generations. But she urged Congress to step up spending, partly because the real interest burden to finance the debt is currently negative. Let's listen.
Interest rates matter, and a way of thinking about the burden of the debt and deficits on the economy is how many resources does the federal government need to pay interest on the debt? And the real interest rate right now is negative.
Are you worried about the growing national debt? How do you think we should deal with it? Think about it. 800-642-1234. David Wessel is a senior fellow in economic studies at Brookings and director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy. David, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, this is complicated, and there is a long history here, but our national debt, it currently stands at more than $28 trillion. Can you point to something on this roadmap of how we set out to accumulate this debt?
Well, it's pretty simple. Almost every year, the government spends more money than it takes in taxes, and it borrows the difference. And the debt is simply the total amount of money we've borrowed every year added up together. It's a remarkable achievement, actually, that we have managed to borrow money, much of it from the rest of the world, currently at very low interest rates, without having any of the obvious economic ill effects that a lot of people worried would happen.
What are those economic ill effects? What might be some issues?
All right. So why do we worry about how much money the government owes? The basic reason we worry is that if the government borrows a lot of money, they're consuming savings, both from Americans and people around the world, and it's not available to the private sector to invest in things that might produce faster productivity growth, higher living standards in the future. So at some point, the government takes so much of the savings that the private sector has to scramble and to get the money it needs to finance new factories, new offices, research on new drugs, new software, and so forth. And one of the reasons that people like Janet Yellen, who, after all, had worried about the debt previously, are not really worried right now, is that the fact that interest rates are so low suggests that there's what former Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke has called a global savings glut. That is, there's so much savings in the world that the private sector doesn't, for some reason, want to use it to invest in productive investments. And so that leaves room for the government to borrow lots of money without pushing up interest rates.
Yeah, but how long can the world's central banks keep interest rates at near zero levels?
So it's important to remember that this is not an artifact of what the world's central banks are doing.
Okay.
The interest rates in global markets have been on a steady decline since the 1980s. Yes, the Fed is definitely keeping interest rates lower than they otherwise would be, but the rates that the market sets are very low. Economists estimate something called the natural rate of interest, which is a terrible name. But what it means is, what would the interest rate be if everything were wonderful, we were at full employment and we had stable prices? And that estimate has been coming down. So, but you ask a good question, how long can this go on? And anybody who answers that definitively is either a genius or a liar. Most economists thought that when we got to this point where the federal debt is roughly the same size as the overall economy, we would have been seeing some ill effects by now. You may remember that there was a commission appointed by President Obama called the Simpson-Bowles Commission for Senator Simpson and Erskine Bowles, who was a former OMB director. And they warned, as others had, that like catastrophe lay around the corner unless we did something.
Mm-hmm.
And catastrophe has not yet arrived. You know, there's an old story. You're standing at a bus stop waiting for a bus, and it doesn't come, and it doesn't come, and it doesn't come. So you're kind of left with two options. One, it's a holiday and the bus is never going to come, or three buses are going to come altogether. And so we don't really know when the too much debt is too much and it starts to hurt the economy. We do know that it doesn't seem to be hurting now. And most economists think that we have some wiggle room. And the reason they think that is because interest rates remain low. But that's not to say this can go on forever. The federal debt, even before Joe Biden became president, was growing faster than the economy is growing. And it's simply impossible to keep that up forever. So when people say it's unsustainable, they mean something's got to give. Either we have to spend less or raise more taxes or something. But it doesn't seem imminent. And what President Biden is saying is we don't need to worry about it right now. And so far, the bond markets seem to agree with him.
We're talking with David Wessel, Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at Brookings, Director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy, as we discuss our national debt increasing to historic highs and what it means for the future. Are you concerned about growing national debt, or is that overblown? Should we cut government spending or raise taxes to rein in debt? What services would you like to see cut to pay down the debt? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. David, government spending, government debt is often analyzed through this ratio of debt to gross domestic product, your GDP. Can you explain expressing it through this ratio and how this percentage factors into how we think about our debt?
So we need to have some way to compare over time and to compare across countries. So when we say that the U.S. government spent in the current fiscal year $7 trillion, we have to think about how do we compare that to what the government of Bermuda spends. I mean, $7 trillion would be huge for Bermuda. It's mm-hmm. merely enormous for us. So one reason we compare use percentage of GDP, percentage of the size of the economy, is allow us to look across countries which are different sizes. But the other reason is things change over time as prices go up. So if I told you that we had spent $7 trillion in 1947, that would have been a whole lot more buying power, whole lot more stuff than $7 trillion is today. So economists kind of use as a way to calibrate, a way to make good comparisons across time. The same way that when you go to get a mortgage, the bank or other mortgage originator may compare how much debt you're going to take on and how much your monthly payments will be to the size of your income. Because if I get a mortgage that costs me $2,000 a month, that's really different than somebody getting a mortgage that costs $2,000 a month if his name is Bill Gates. So doing as a percentage of income is just a convenient way to standardize over time and to compare across countries.
And when you look across the world, across countries, you see Japan topping the list with their country's debt to GDP ratio, 257-odd%. What is going on in Japan?
Well, one of the reasons that everybody is kind of rethinking the old rules of thumb about the debt is we would have thought in the past that Japan would be an economic disaster with that kind of debt. So what's happened in Japan is really two things. One is Japan is an aging society, and aging societies tend to spend more money because the government spends more on old people, both in Japan and here, than it does on young people. But secondly, Japan is a high savings economy, so Japan has a lot of debt, but most of it is owed to other Japanese people. The U.S. is in a different position. Much of our debt, somewhere about between, 30 or 40% these days, is owed to foreigners, because high savings countries like Japan and China are looking for some place to put their savings. They can't find enough places in their home countries to put it, so they lend it to us. They lend it to the U.S. government. And one of the things I think about sometimes is, so let's say you were the woman who runs the Chinese foreign exchange reserves, and your boss says to you one day, you know, I'm tired of the United States. They're a mess. We should put our money somewhere else. And about 5 minutes later, the woman comes back and says to her boss, you know, boss, here's the problem. We have a lot of money. There are not a lot of places that are big enough for us to put our money. Japan is one of them, but look, they're a shrinking society, literally a shrinking society, and they have a deliberate policy of reducing the value of their currency. So if we put money in there, it's going to not do well. Europe is the only other alternative, and Europe can't seem to agree that it actually wants to have a common currency in the euro. So they end up investing in the United States, not because everything is great here, but we just look better than all the other alternatives.
Better than all the options out there. Yeah.
I like to say we're the world's tallest midget.
We're with David Wessel of the Hutchins Center at Brookings, breaking down our nation's debt burden and how to think about it in these pandemic times. Where do you think the U.S. government spends most of its money? Should we spend less on military or cut Social Security benefits or foreign aid? Do you think concerns about the debt are warranted or overblown? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with David Wessel here on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour on our rising national debt. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Biden laid out a $6 trillion budget proposal Friday that would take our country to its highest sustained levels of federal spending since World War II. The administration said in the budget document for the 2022 fiscal year, quote, it charts a fiscally responsible path for delivering a stronger, more prosperous economy. What do you think? 800-642-1234. David Wessel is Director of Fiscal and Monetary Policy at Brookings, and he's with us for the hour. Jeff is joining us from Appleton. Hi, Jeff. What are your thoughts on the debt?
Oh, it absolutely is worth all of the trouble, worth all the thought and fear that it's bringing. Our economy is probably not going to show any problems because our people are all used to living in debt. Debt means nothing to the people in the United States, so nobody's really going to get scared by it. It will be, as a guest said, it'll be China telling us that, no, you've gone too far, and we're not going to invest in you anymore. It is a huge issue. And as far as fixing it, if our government could simply get a hold of the waste and cut the waste and run themselves in a lean manner like most of our corporations have to, that would go a long way to fixing this. But the longer we wait, the longer we kick this can down the road, the harder and the worse the measures are going to be to fix it. And I don't see a whole lot of people, including President Biden, that really understand that.
Jeff, thank you. So cutting wasteful spending is at the core, David.
I don't actually think so. First of all, there's no line item in the federal budget for cutting waste, fraud, and abuse. Politicians have been promising to do this for years. Is there some waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal budget? Absolutely. But the reason we are spending so much money is that we spend a lot of money on old people and healthcare, and we don't collect enough in taxes to cover the increases in spending on old people and healthcare. And yes, it would be better if we had less waste and it would restore people's confidence. But the fact is that there's just not, we're never going to get the waste out to solve this problem in the long run. I'm also sometimes amused by people who think that the government should be run more like a corporation. Most of us who work have worked for big corporations, as I have not felt that they were devoid of waste, fraud, and abuse. There's a lot of excess in corporations. We see this all the time. So while it would be nice that we could sort of have the painless fix, one where we only cut out the waste and the fraud and the abuse. The fact is we're not going to be able to do that. Either we're going to have to restrain spending increases or we're going to raise taxes. And my guess is we're going to do both.
So what about the sentiment, though, that we're all living in debt and we've kind of, you know, gained immunity from it? It doesn't mean anything to the people in the U.S. anymore.
Well, I'm sometimes allergic to the notion that we should think of the federal government the same as we do a company or a household. After all, the one thing about the federal government, it basically kind of lives forever. And it manages to borrow at very low interest rates because so far, U.S. government debt is seen as the safest asset in the world. In fact, what's happened recently is American households have kind of stopped, have restrained their borrowing a bit during the pandemic, and the government has increased it. But the fact is that people, I don't think that people right now are really worried about the federal debt. I don't see any people marching on the mall in Washington with big signs saying, cut my Medicare or raise my taxes. And I think the reason they're not worried about it is that the economy is fortunately getting better from the pandemic. And people are buying houses, those who can afford to and can find, can get one in this crazy housing market we have, at very low interest rates. So since there's no apparent, and the stock market's going up and unemployment's coming down. So it's hard to get worried about something when the economy seems to be getting better. And also, I think that one of the things the pandemic has demonstrated to a lot of people is, well, maybe the government actually does do some things and maybe it's okay to spend some money. And so there's less appetite for cutting spending now than I've seen in my career in Washington, which is now 40 years.
We're talking with David Wessel of Brookings, discussing the historic high of government debt and how to think about it in the future. Kyle is joining us from Menominee. Hi, Kyle. What is your thoughts here?
So my thoughts are, like, when we look at the national debt, my understanding is it's basically a difference between the amount of money we've printed over the years versus the amount of money we have collected in taxes. And as long as we're not causing inflation, the national debt shouldn't be a huge issue. And I also understand that if we aren't running a deficit, or if the government's not running a deficit, that means private industry and the American public are then running a deficit because the government's collecting more in taxes than they are in than they are spending. And every time that's happened for a prolonged period of time, I believe it's caused a recession because private industry stops investing when they're turning a deficit. So I guess my question is, why do we continue to look at it as a household budget when the government can actually print money, which obviously the American public can't do? Otherwise, we go to jail.
Kyle, thank you. David Wessel.
So I don't see it quite that way, but there's a germ of a good point in what the caller makes. So first of all, let's be clear about two words, defining two words. The deficit is the difference between what the government spends and what it takes in. So in the current fiscal year, the government collected about $3.6 trillion in taxes. But it spent $7.3 trillion. So it had a deficit of about $3.7 trillion. That's the deficit. That's the annual cash flow. The debt is the total amount of money that we've borrowed over time. Now, I think the caller is onto something is there are two reasons to worry about big government deficits. One reason is that it adds to the debt. And if we continue to add to the debt every year by more than the economy grows, eventually we're going to have to do something. That's the kind of big long-term worry about the debt. But the other issue is when we have a recession, when we have a pandemic and everybody's told to stay home and stop spending, the government can spend a lot of money and indeed should spend a lot of money borrowing to in order to keep people eating and clothed and to pay for healthcare and all that stuff. When the economy gets back to full employment, that is when most people who want jobs have them, if the government keeps spending more than it takes in, we could get inflation. And so far that hasn't happened. But one of the concerns about what's happened in the last year and what President Biden is proposing is that we had this kind of emergency government budget during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Now it's not an emergency. If we keep spending too much, we get inflation and that will force the Fed to raise interest rates. And there's a lot of debate about whether we're at that point now or not.
We're with David Wessel from Brookings looking at the federal debt. It has surpassed $28 trillion. And how to put this large number into perspective, understand the implications. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with David Wessel after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about our nation's debt burden on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen testified before Congress Thursday ahead of the release of President Biden's 2022 budget proposal. Yellen said the budget is fiscally responsible.
The president's proposal, you'll see, will have a temporary period of spending and permanent increases that beyond the budget window will result in lower deficits and more tax revenue to support those expenditures. I believe it is a fiscally responsible program.
The budget proposal projects that the debt will rise to 117% of the size of the economy by 2031. David Wessel, watching all this, senior fellow in economic studies at Brookings, with us for the hour. So, David, you know, in recent decades, both political parties have steadily driven up the debt. Are complaints about the debt politically motivated?
Yes. Look, it seems to be, while there used to be a core of members of Congress who worried a lot about the debt, no matter who was president, these days, the Republicans didn't worry at all about the mounting debt when they were cutting taxes in 2017. And some Democrats made some noises about that. They said the tax cut was irresponsible because it would add to the debt. Now that we have a Democrat in the White House, suddenly some Republicans have discovered their inner fiscal responsibility gene, and they're complaining about the size of the debt. And some of the Democrats who criticized President Trump are suddenly not worried about the debt. So there's hypocrisy is not a new development in Washington. This is just particularly stark.
Let's bring in Rick now in Evansville. Rick, hi.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have one kind of 2 points all at the same time. Yes, the debt is a growing problem that we need to worry about. Yes, deficit spending is a problem, but not as big a problem. But the biggest part of the problem comes from not how much we're spending, but where we're spending it. I mean, we're giving billions and trillions of dollars away every year to corporations in tax credits, and we're spending billions and trillions of dollars on high-end weapon systems for the military and all of this kind of thing, instead of investing in infrastructure, investing in public employees, investing in pay and living conditions for soldiers and servicemen all over the world, and supporting lower-income workers, subsidizing teachers and nurses' pay, that kind of thing, which would be an absolute benefit for the entire economy. I mean, study after study has shown that when you give money to the rich, they put it in the bank. When you give money to the working class people, they go out and spend it and circulate it back into the economy.
So Rick is saying it's about the spending priorities here, David.
Well, I think he's right that it's important to look at not how much the government spends, but what it spends it on. And I think sometimes people have a warped idea or uninformed idea of where the money goes. You know, people think, oh, we should not spend so much money on foreign aid. Well, that's something like 1.5% of the budget. So if you look at the federal budget, 25% of the money is in the annually appropriated spending, the stuff that Congress has to approve every year, roughly 50-50 defense and non-defense. 70% of the budget is in benefit programs, sometimes called entitlements. And that includes Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid, veterans pensions, and so forth. And about 5% is interest on the federal debt. And there is a good case to be made that the government spends too much on subsidizing current consumption and not enough on investment. And what President Biden is basically saying is, I want to shift that priority. So the reason that Janet Yellen can say we have a fiscally responsible budget is he is proposing to raise taxes on corporations and rich people and use that money to give to lower income people and to put into things that are investments like R&D and infrastructure. So there's a strong case to be made that we need to reorient the federal government's spending priorities towards more investment in the future and a little less subsidizing current consumption. And then I think the caller made, but as the caller indicated, sometimes we have the situation where if I think it's a good idea, I call it investment. Increasing the pay on soldiers and airmen and sailors, that's not what most economists would consider investment, but the caller did. So there's a bit of a difficult time sometimes deciding that. And finally, the caller's absolutely right that we, quote, spend a lot of money on tax credits. It's more popular for Congress to say, I'm going to give a tax credit to someone, that is, reduce the taxes they owe, than to say, I'm going to write them a check for that amount of money. But economically, it's basically the same thing.
Well, when you look at after the end of World War II, Social Security was in its early years. Medicare and Medicaid didn't come about until 1965. What about the makings of the safety net programs in relation to the debt that we see?
Well, the reason the government is bigger than it used to be is that we decided as a society to have a much stronger safety net. Actually, it's not as strong as the safety nets we see in some Western European countries. And so Social Security at the moment is actually not adding to the debt because the payroll taxes are enough to basically cover the benefits. Medicare and Medicaid are paid for. They add to the debt because we don't collect enough money to pay our bills. What people worry about, or the people I respect worry about, is the trend. And the trend is as the society gets older, because we have a big baby boom generation, people are living longer, and importantly, fertility rates, the number of babies that the average woman has been going down. We're getting to a situation where we're going to have fewer and fewer tax-paying workers and more benefit-receiving older people. And secondly, healthcare costs continue to rise faster than everything else, and the government picks up a big chunk of healthcare. So the fundamental drivers of the federal debt going forward are three things: old people, healthcare, and not collecting enough in taxes to cover those. And so something's going to have to give there. It will eventually. The history suggests that eventually we do something. In the early 1980s, Congress, in the Reagan era, there was a big compromise, and they gradually raised the Social Security retirement age. So we will do something someday. I think the issue about waiting is that the longer you wait, the more likely it is we're going to have to do it on taxes, because it's much easier to raise taxes from one year to the next than it is to cut benefits. And I think some people on the left think that's what they want to do. They would rather have a big government, and they'd rather pay for it by having higher taxes. And we may get there. The one thing we can't do is say we want a bigger government but collect less in taxes. And that was kind of the Trump strategy, and that's one reason why we have such a big debt.
David Wessel with us of Brookings, author of Red Ink, Inside the High Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. We're discussing the nation's debt burden, what it means for future generations with your insights, 800-642-1234. David is joining us from La Crosse. Hi, David. What is on your mind?
Hi. I just wanted to say I really like the analogy that was made about the investment from Japan, where, you know, the U.S. debt is the best investment there is. I also wanted to get the speaker's viewpoint on some of the concerns that I've heard is that, you know, the oil will go to a different currency for its value. I don't really see this as being a realistic possibility because all the other currencies are having a lot of their own issues. And I also wanted to comment on, I think the two things that we should be cutting are, I know you addressed the foreign aid is a huge portion of our debt, but it is a portion. And defense spending. It seems to me that those are the two big things that we could kind of cut back.
David, thank you. Looking also at the value of oil, David Wessel.
What the caller said is something that people worry about, which is one reason we can borrow so much money cheaply is that everybody around the world wants to hold either U.S. Treasury debt or, in fact, they want to hold U.S. dollar, $100 bills. There's a huge amount of money circulating around the world, much of it used for illicit activities in $100 bills, and that's another way of the rest of the world lends us money. There have been warnings for years that the U.S. dollar will lose its premier status. Those worries became quite pronounced when the euro was formed in the early 1990s. But so far, the dollar's market share has remained strong for the reasons the caller said. Currencies don't tend to dominate forever. Once upon a time, the British pound was the world's reserve currencies, and that gave way to the dollar. And it might someday happen to us, but it doesn't seem to be imminent. I think that the other thing is that the caller said is, I mean, the issue about, in fact, the deficit is not being driven very much by annually appropriated spending on things like defense and foreign aid. And I think there's, you know, people look around the world and say the world is a somewhat less safe place than it seemed a few years ago. China's a rising power. And so some people who used to think that we spent too much on defense are now a little more sympathetic. That's a political decision. I don't think we're going to cut the defense budget. I don't think the current administration wants to go there. I think they may redirect some of it. You mentioned something about oil, and I'm not sure what you were referring to. I think the dollar.
Yeah, and he had mentioned the value of oil and what impact that has on the overall economy and the world.
Well,
yeah.
Well, I mean, oil is a big part of the world economy, mm-hmm. and when the price of oil goes up, that's kind of like a tax. The U.S. is much less dependent on foreign oil than it used to be because of the whole oil shale revolution, and so we're a lot less vulnerable to unrest in the Middle East. But I think over time, the issue about oil is less OPEC and more climate change than the struggle to put a tax on carbon or to subsidize wind and hydro and solar and maybe even someday going back to nuclear will make oil and coal less appealing because I think the world is coming to realize that we can't continue to rely on fossil fuels if we're going to arrest the warming of the planet. So that's a big deal, a huge change in the economy. It's going to require a lot of technological change, a lot of advancement. We've made a lot of progress there, and it's going to be pretty upsetting to some established industries. I mean, we recently saw in the business world having a company like Exxon have two people get elected to their board who are dissidents who say you're not worrying enough about climate change, I think is a real milestone.
David Wessel of Brookings, our guide to federal debt, whether it's worrisome when we're looking more broadly at the economy. How should the Great Depression, Great Recession, what we face now in a COVID pandemic, inform how we view the federal debt? Well, still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with David Wessel on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the growing federal debt this hour. A shout out to Scott from Baldwin, who suggested that we talk more about the national debt. Scott said that we're paying millions of dollars of interest on the debt each month, and yet rich are paying less in taxes. David Wessel of Brookings, he's with us for analysis for 10 more minutes. Rich in Rhinelander would like to take a moment to look at China. Hi, Rich. Go ahead.
Hi, I was wondering if you had already talked about or discussed. China has this sort of command capitalistic system where they're going great guns, you know, and that's not a pun on their military build up. They're going great guns on building high speed rail and cities and roads. And we were told that when tax cuts occurred to a certain sector of the American population, that would really stoke the economy, that we'd be highly competitive with places like China. And I know we're not that system, but aren't there ideas to be looked at about how a society builds itself for the future?
Rich, thank you.
Well, that's a pretty big question. So, you know, Tom Friedman, the columnist for the New York Times, used to talk a lot about how it took as much time to replace the escalators at his subway station in suburban Washington as it took the Chinese to build an entire, stadium. So I think that, yes, there are some things that the Chinese have learned to do well that we can learn from. They have, for instance, in terms of mobile payment and stuff, they're ahead of us. I think I speak for myself. I'm not sure that I am sure I don't want to trade our messy capitalist economy for their command and control thing where people are put in jail for saying unpopular things, or where the internet is censored, or where my former colleagues at the Wall Street Journal were tossed out of the country because they were writing things the government doesn't like. So there's China is an economic miracle. They've lifted more people out of poverty in a shorter period of time than we've ever seen in the history of the world. But I'm not ready to trade our system for theirs. I do think that there are some things that we can learn from them. Can I mention one other thing just before I forget?
Sure, go ahead.
People often have a hard time absorbing all these numbers about the federal budget. So my shop at Brookings built a little computer game. It's on www.fiscalship.org. And you can, first you pick your goals for government, big government, fight climate change, reduce inequality, bolster national defense. And then we give you about 100 or so tax and spending options to see, can you realize your goals for government and stabilize the federal debt? And I think it's a good way for people to appreciate the trade-offs. They're hard, right? Mm. If we want to stabilize the federal debt, we're going to have to restrain some spending that we kind of like, or we're going to have to raise taxes more than most people think they want to do. And everybody wants more spending on their favorite thing, and nobody wants to pay more taxes. And so the game is a way to help people see what the choices are. And it shows that you can do this, but you have to be able to make some hard decisions.
Yeah. And when you look at the fiscal ship then, and this messy capitalist society, and the problems that we face, the pandemic, the recession, climate change, poverty, racism, where would you rank the national debt?
I wouldn't rank it very high at the moment. Look, fighting the pandemic is the best investment we can make in the future. There's no doubt about that. And we use the federal budget. The federal budget is a way, a statement of our priorities. And as the caller said, it's not only how much money, but what you spend it on. Mm. So spending more money to invest in poor children in healthcare and education so they can grow up to be higher wage earning, more productive members of society is a good investment in the future. So I think that right now, especially with interest rates so low, there's a strong case for making investments, as long as they're really investments, and putting off the dealing with the federal debt for a few years, recognizing that it's always easy to say a few more years, a few more years.
Well, you mentioned COVID. With the economic fallout from the pandemic, do you see that having a transitory effect on the overall economy, or do you see that being much more permanent and long-lasting?
You know, I think we don't really know.
Okay.
We're a pretty resilient society. Some things will change. Look, some things changed after 9/11. We all got used to going through metal detectors at the airport. None of us like it, but, you know, we kind of all got used to it. The world of work is going to be different after the pandemic. We are going to, in my company, the Brookings Institution, we're going to be at work 3 days a week and 2 days a week at home. I think we've grown in appreciation for how important frontline workers are. You know, we used to call them low wage, low skilled workers. Now we call them essential workers, the people who work at grocery stores or clean the floors at hospitals or deliver for Amazon and FedEx and stuff like that. So I think something will change, but, it probably won't change as much as it felt like it was going to, because I already see things returning a little bit closer to normal. But that's just a guess.
All right. Well, Michael in Milwaukee wants to talk about a book. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if the guests had ever read The Deficit Myth by Stephanie Kelton, who is an economist. Is, I guess, espousing the modern monetary theory, MMT, basically saying that the deficit is really something that is a myth because the federal government has a sovereign currency, can print their own money. It's a matter of bookkeeping.
Hmm. And we're short on time. Yeah, go ahead, David.
Yeah, real short. So there's some things about modern monetary theory that seem to fit the current situation we're in. It turns out that the government can borrow a lot more money more safely. Where I worry about the modern monetary theory is they think that the Fed shouldn't worry about inflation. They think that the Congress should keep spending money until we get inflation. And then when inflation shows up, they're counting on Congress to tighten the belts and help us avoid an unwelcome increase in inflation. And I'm not really comfortable with that. But it's a longer conversation we can have than in the 90 seconds.
And David, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
David Wessel is a senior fellow in economic studies at Brookings and director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy. He wrote the book Red Ink. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.